You're listening to the Miscarriage Doula Podcast. I'm your host, Arden Cartrett. This space is meant to be a tool for you to feel less alone and to learn more about how to get through what you've been through and what you're probably going through. We'll hear diverse stories from women and men in the online space, experts and people just like you and me who are feeling the effects of miscarriage and loss in real time. This is the Miscarriage Doula Podcast. Measure the Placenta is calling on all stillbirth mamas or lost moms with a passion for preventing stillbirth to write letters to the ACOG asking them to make EPV measurements a standard care in pregnancy. To date, over 3,500 letters have been sent, and they could really use your voice to continue making a difference. To learn more, visit the link in today's show description, and you can find all of Measure the Placenta's freebies, all about their letter writing campaign, and their social media. Amanda, thank you so much for joining me today and for coming on to share your story and also a little bit about Measure the Placenta, which is something that I found actually in my second living son's pregnancy, because doing all of this work, I learned a lot about stillbirth and that kind of freaked me out. And I wanted to be more knowledgeable than fearful. And I thought that that was really empowering. And so that's how I came across you and Measure the Placenta. I'd love to start with the audience learning more about you and your story and what brings you to the advocacy work on Measure the Placenta.
Sure. So I've got kind of a unique story, a unique start to my story is that before I even lost a child, I became involved as a volunteer photographer with the Star Legacy Foundation. So my name is Amanda. I'm the mom of three kids. We'll start there. I've got three beautiful girls, Juniper, Coral, and Jersey. Juniper was stillborn at full term in August of 2018. We met our living daughter, Coral, 363 days later in the exact same room that Junie was born in, which was really special. And then 2 years later, we had Jersey. So Coral is almost 3 years old at the time of this recording, and Jersey is almost a year old, and Juniper would be four. So before I even got pregnant with Juniper, our first, I'm a photographer by trade, and I wanted to give back by using my talents to give back. So I went through the training to be a volunteer photographer. And it's so silly. At the time, I was like, I don't know if I could ever volunteer, but I was like, I'm going to do this training to just be a more compassionate type of person. So then soon after, I think it was like a month after I did the training, I got pregnant with Juniper. And so then I never did volunteer. Their policy is you don't volunteer if you're pregnant. At my 20-week ultrasound with Junie, which was our first ultrasound, she was measuring small. And then I also had a fibroid on my uterus, which had not been detected prior to my pregnancy. And it was 10 centimeters in size. So that was kind of crazy. And so because she was measuring so small, there was a lot of confusion with my due date, since I didn't have a first trimester ultrasound. So then my doctor sent me to an MFM to start doing more growth checks. And then we started doing weekly biophysical profiles and non-stress tests. And then her growth, she kept growing, but her growth kept dropping on the charts. Like, it was slower and slower. And then I was diagnosed with preeclampsia. And they told me that her growth restriction, the IUGR, intrauterine growth restriction, was likely due to placental insufficiency. And ironically enough, like, you know, hindsight's 2020. But when they had told us that, we were like, okay, you're measuring everything. You're measuring the four chambers of her heart. You're measuring this and that. Measure the placenta. Like, can you measure the placenta? Like, you're saying that she's not growing well because her placenta is not doing well. And they were like, no, we don't do that. That's not necessary, you know, yada, yada, yada. So then we were doing the checks weekly. We went to twice a week just because her growth kept falling on the charts. When I was about 28 weeks pregnant, they ultimately changed my due date by 11 days. And it was possibly up to 13 days difference, partially due to a typo on my ultrasound report at the 20 week at the hospital. And then also because she was small. So they thought that by changing my due date, it would accommodate her small growth, which for most pregnancies that don't have complications, changing a due date isn't a big deal, or, you know, the due date isn't as big of a deal. But when it comes to highly growth restricted babies, it's a big deal, because at 37 weeks, stillbirth rates go up exponentially because the placenta shuts down. The placenta, you know, can't do it. So when they changed my due date, then ultimately the day that she died and was born, my chart said I was 36 weeks and 3 days, but I was actually 38 weeks and 2 days. Yeah. So we found out she had died at my last regularly scheduled appointment on Thursday, August 9th of 2018. We went to my MFM. Luckily, my husband was with me. You know, I'd been going so frequently, but it was a growth check. And so it was Thursday, and I was going to be induced Monday if I didn't go into labor before that. And with the like due date change, they wanted me to get to 37 weeks. And, but, you know, in hindsight, I was already 37 weeks on the day she died, or I was 38 and two. So we went in for my regularly scheduled growth check, and the ultrasound tech started scanning, and like, I knew what was wrong right away, but I didn't want to like believe it. And like, she left the room and my husband was like, what's wrong? I'm like, well, the heart's not beating. But like in my mind, I'm like, oh, the machine isn't working. The TV's not connected. Like, that was a baby before us, you know, whatever. Right. Yeah. Which was, you know, the worst moment of my life, to then have the doctor come in and tell us that there is no heartbeat. And then that's when I just, you know, immediately dropped back to that training that I had gone through. Like, I was full term. I knew I was going to have to give birth, even though she had died. But also, you know, we didn't want to believe it yet at that point. I remember like very distinctly not wanting to leave the room, because then it was going to be real.
Yeah.
And so we left the MFM clinic. We stopped home, and then we went to the hospital. And I delivered her later that night at 7:41 PM. And that sucked, that, you know, while I was in labor, I think we still thought like, oh, maybe they're wrong. Maybe the machine was broken or whatever. So our families got to come in and meet her. I had a friend come and photograph, and it was really weird because no one prepares you to go through something like this. But in a way, I was prepared with that training. And yeah. So I remember the time in the hospital, like I kind of felt like I knew what to do. And then once we left, which was the worst, I still don't know how my legs carried me out of that room. But then it was kind of like, okay, now what? Now what do I do? So then after that, I, as a photographer, I wanted to share photos of my daughter. And I quickly found out that there was so much taboo around stillbirth and around grief. And I just wanted to show off pictures of her. I wanted to be validated as a mom. I had so many people tell me, you'll be a great mom someday. I'm like, no, I'm already a mom. Like, this is terrible. And so I started posting photos to Instagram, and with like inspirational quotes or, you know, what have you, you know. And then I like discovered a whole community of moms around the country and around the world. And I felt so much less alone at that point. And then I also just found that no one knew how to navigate it. And I felt like everyone was approaching me in ways I did not like. I found I have a very unique approach to grief. And I just found that like people just wanted me to like get over and forget about my daughter. And then like, we'll try again. Like, I'm like, well, I can't even wipe right now. Like, I'm like, babies are not replaceable. Like, humans are unique people. Not replaceable. So since Junie was born, I just personally kind of started talking a lot on Instagram about grief and stillbirth. And it was also just mind-blowing that before Junie, I thought like, okay, if you're pregnant and you're going to a clinic, like for a lot of checks, like, you know, something's wrong, you know, something could go wrong. But in my experience, it almost felt the opposite. It felt like the attitude that I was given from them was nothing could go wrong because they were watching me so close, you know, and reassuring me that it was going to be okay, or they would check, they would, you know, catch something before it happened. And like in hindsight, like no one ever educated me on kick counts at the time. You know, and we even asked about like measuring the baby's placenta, and that was, you know, not necessary, and things like that. So, I just, you know, started talking on Instagram and stuff. And then I also became involved in some parent panels, with Star Legacy Foundation. And, so a few months after Junior was born, we found out we were pregnant again with our second daughter. And we don't find out the genders. So that's always a fun part of our pregnancies. And we call them little effers as the play off our last name. So that's fun. So I was like halfway through my pregnancy with Coral, and I was on my way to a parent panel with another a couple, and their son Elijah had died a month before Junie did. And you know, we had an autopsy done with Junie, and you know, didn't get any information from that. The hospital, you know, looked at her placenta. Didn't really show, you know, didn't tell us anything. It was just that she was small and then we left her too long type of a conclusion. So I met this other mom and dad, Elijah's mom and dad, Ann and David O'Neill. And we started talking on our way to this parent panel. We were carpooling, and she tells me, and I mentioned something about how they said her placenta wasn't doing what it should, the preeclampsia, things like that. And then she tells me that placentas can be measured in pregnancy, and that there is a Harvard doctor, a placenta researcher named Dr. Kleiman, who has developed a technique to measure placentas in pregnancy. It's very simple, done on ultrasound. And it was just like mind blowing that like, wow, like here I am months later. And, you know, my doctors are just like, try again. Like I felt like I went for like follow-up appointments after Junior was born to be like, you know, you were watching me so close, like what happened? And they were just like, try again. Like, nope, we did what we could. And like my one doctor tried to reassure me that like less than 1% of babies die after having a passing NST and BPP, like within a week or something.
Feel better?
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So like, that was just, it was weird and interesting to navigate. And like, of course, going into then my second pregnancy, I wanted to do everything we could to get a baby here alive and to not like leave it up to chance. So a big difference right away was having that first trimester ultrasound done, locking in that due date and all of those things. And then, you know, knowing the importance of counting kicks. So anyways, when I connected then with Elijah's mom, and she was telling me about this measuring the placenta technique, I was just like mind blown of like, wow, like we even asked in my pregnancy with Juniper if the placenta could be measured. And, you know, high risk specialty clinic, maternal fetal medicine, we're like, no, like if anyone can do it, it should be them, you know?
Right.
So I started looking into it, and Dr. Kleiman does placenta reports. He can, when, in most hospitals in the United States, when there is a loss, they keep the placenta on file. They take cuts of the placenta. If you kind of think of a placenta as like, if you cut down a tree and you can see the rings, when you take like a section cut out of a placenta, it's kind of a similar idea there. So if you have a loss, your hospital will take cuts of the placenta and keep them on file, generally speaking. You know, even though this was months after Junia died, I was able to send those slides, like pieces of her placenta, the placenta belongs to the baby, not to the mom, off to him and all of my records. And then he was able to like look more into things in more detail. Most pathologists at hospitals do not know much about placentas. And they're a very unique organ. They are grown to sustain your baby in pregnancy. And each time you get pregnant, another, you know, you create a new placenta and then birth it after the baby. So it's just, you know, it's a much more specialized type of a thing to be looking at. So even though our hospital report said Junie's placenta, nothing was remarkable, sent all the info off to Dr. Kleiman for his reporting. And her placenta was 0.1 percentile for size. So it was wow. way too small. And I don't have a picture of it. I wish I did when she was born, but I do remember my doctor saying that it was calcified. It was hard and chunk, like it was aged, you know? Hold on. Lost my train of thought.
You're totally
I don't know how much you edit this, but
I so usually, just... if there's space or anything, I could totally okay, edit super.
This. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. So then getting Dr. Kleiman's report back on Junie's placenta and seeing that it was 0.1 percentile for size, like that's a big deal. You know, you take your kids to the pediatrician and if they're, you know, under whatever percentage, it's like, oh my gosh, like, let's be concerned. But yet my hospital checked out my placenta and it raised no red flags. Like that just, it just blows my mind. So also at this time, around the time Dr. Kleiman did my report, Elijah's mom and I were at the stillbirth summit and Dr. Kleiman was there. And so it was just like a great meeting of the minds. And so then we just started discussing more and more about, you know, this is just it's a no-brainer. Like we should be measuring a placenta in a pregnancy, like especially when it comes to a high-risk pregnancy, such as a growth restriction, or if there's preeclampsia involved, gestational diabetes, whatever, what have you, different cord insertions, things like that. Also, I just want to throw out a disclaimer. I am not a science person. I am a photographer. I am not giving like medical advice. I now, with our Measure the Placenta advocacy team, I do social media. So just for anyone listening, default to the actual scientist placental people. This is just things I have learned and share as a lost mom and as a stillbirth prevention advocate. So just wanted to throw that one out there. So a group of us sort of kind of loosey-goosey came together and created a advocacy team called Measure the Placenta. And our goal is to get the estimated placental volumes, EPVs, as a part of prenatal care in pregnancies, especially when it comes to risk situations. Although we do like to say you are only low risk until you become high risk. So there's really, you know, a low risk pregnancy is kind of a misnomer.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people's first pregnancies are where they have outcomes like this or, you know, different diagnosis that would make them high risk if it was a second pregnancy. And
right.
You don't know until you know.
When Junie was diagnosed as IUGR, you know, you go to the Google because that's what you do. You go to your where you can find information. And a lot of people or a lot of things said about taking baby aspirin. So I asked my OB about like taking baby aspirin and it's like, well, you had no history of anything. So like, why would we start, you know? So then I did do baby aspirin in my subsequent living children pregnancies. And as we're recording this right now, Christina Perry, the singer, she wrote the like Twilight song. Mm-hmm. She's been sharing a lot about petitioning ACOG to add a blood test to check for the antiphospholipid syndrome, APS.
Good.
And kind of the same idea of like, they don't check for that stuff until you've had multiple losses. And that just, I feel like anything else in the world, we wouldn't like make people go through tragedy multiple times before we start doing something about it.
You're talking my language. Like, I get fired up about this all the time. Same. And some doctors, you know, some doctors will say, oh, well, we can't do anything until you've had three miscarriages, which alone is outdated information. That was, it's never even been like a law or anything that's put into place. It's just an opinion by, you know, organizations that write a bunch of stuff for doctors to follow. And that was
that's 2012. But it's become like common law now of like, we won't do anything until three. And like, it just doesn't make sense to me at all.
Well, it's almost like if you had a test or anything that could prevent something from happening again, if you can't prevent it from happening right now, why wouldn't you do that?
Right. Especially when it's something that's minimal. It's non-invasive.
Yeah.
You know, it just, we aren't, you know, with things like this measuring of the placenta or like Christina Perry's, we're not asking for daily MRIs. We're not asking for amnios left and right. Like,
right.
We're asking to measure something. We're asking to check, do a blood test. Like, it's not, it's nothing like to the moon or over the top. So
no, not at all.
Blows my mind.
And I said at the top of the show that I found you through doing a lot of research for preventable stillbirth, and I came across the, you know, measuring the placenta and the information on your website. And I brought that to my doctor, I asked the technician that was doing my ultrasounds, if she could measure that for me. And she had no idea what I was talking about. She said that she does not know how to measure placenta. She doesn't know that there's a way. And I was like, well, can you at least measure it and see what the computer says, if it's just like equal to my gestation? Like, can you give me something, some indication that like, it's an okay size? And I asked multiple times, multiple different technicians, and not one knew what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we want to change.
Yeah.
With our advocacy team. If anyone listening to this is pregnant or plans or hopes to be pregnant, doing an estimated placental volume, we call it EPV, is very simple. I had them measured on Jersey, my third child's placenta, every time I went into my MFM, starting at 20 weeks. And I think there was times that I was going in like every 2 weeks, because I had a complication arise. But it was so amazing for them to just take these measurements and to see that, because the placental size, should line up with the fetal size. Like that's important, is that they should be in line with each other, sort of thing. If you have a very mismatched placenta size, that is a risk factor, if you have a mismatched placenta size to the fetal size. So if you do want to bring this information to your provider, both our website and Dr. Kleiman's website has an easy guide, and it's three measurements, and it's the length, the width, and I told you I'm not a science person.
The height.
There we go. Okay. Because the placenta, you know, it's not an easy, you know, go-to right. shape. So it's kind of like, and a lot of them kind of curve on the side of the uterus. So then it takes all of 30 seconds to get these measurements taken. It can be done with a regular ultrasound machine. It does not take any sort of special equipment, things like that. The guide explains how to do it. And then once you do have those three measurements, since this is not something built into sonographers' machines yet, there's a free app on both the Apple store and the Android store, Google Play store, whatever it's called, called Merwin's EPV calculator. And that's named for Dr. Kleiman's dad. And he came up with an equation to figure out that percentile volume of that placenta. So if you go to that app, you plug in your baby's gestational age, and then you plug in those three measurements, and then it will tell you what the percentile size of that placental volume is. And it's really slick and really cool. And just, that's it's amazing. So easy to do. Yeah. Are you looking at it right there?
Yes, I know I was. So whenever I went into the doctor, I brought up EPV, and I think I assumed that they would know what I was talking about, because I was like, you're a sonographer.
Yeah.
I just assumed, and I am now realizing that like, it's not, you know, I didn't put it together. I don't know why I didn't put it together that maybe they wouldn't know, but I should preface it with, I had a horrible OBGYN, and they have been since fired, and they also had a typo in my,
oh my goodness,
not to go off on a tangent, but they had a typo in my due date. They had a typo in my weight that put me at an obese BMI, and it changed my entire care for my entire pregnancy.
See, like that's insanity. I think the more and more work I do personally in this space, and the more and more work I do with Measure the Placenta, I'm just fine. The standard of care is not good enough.
No. No.
Like, look, I often wonder back to Junie, like if I hadn't been high risk, if they hadn't been watching so close, I'm like, would I have known to count the kicks? Which, by the way, Count the Kicks in the United States is a great organization for learning about tracking fetal movement, which is a huge way to empower yourself in your pregnancy, is to count the kicks. And then especially if you've had a loss before. Pregnancy after loss is the second hardest thing I've ever done in my life, and I've done it twice. And Junie did slow down the day before she was born, and you know, everyone was like, you were just in. I was in four times the week she died. And every time it was like, she's perfect. She's great. Like, she's passing all the tests. She was small, but she was perfect is what they kept telling me. And so, yeah, like knowing, I just wonder if I had, you know, questioned things more. But when I was being seen so close, and I was reassured, like I said, over and over, that like, we're doing everything we can. And it's like, no, we should do more. A lot of times the doctors, you know, it's not a standard of care yet, which we hope to change. But we hear from doctors that they're afraid that, you know, taking this measurement might cause women to be anxious.
We're already anxious.
Yeah. And like, that just makes me question, like, okay, should we stop taking someone's blood pressure? Because if they know it's a little on the high side, are they going to be anxious? Like, no, we don't do that. We take a blood pressure as a way to inform our pregnancy care. We check a pregnant woman's blood pressure as a way to assess the health of that person and that pregnancy. And so why don't we just add this other tool to the toolbox? Let's start measuring the placenta. And kind of going back to your experience of asking the sonographer to check it, we hear so much that, oh, we're looking at it. We're looking at the placenta. And from my knowledge, it seems like they used to grade placentas. They would give them like a grade, but other than like a visual like opinion, it doesn't seem like that was ever rooted in anything like super scientific or anything that's numerical that we can, you know, track. And now I don't even think they really grade them anymore. They will look at them, but like, okay, pretend like you're pregnant right now. Like, oh, yep, I'm looking at you. Good. Like, what is that accomplishing? I don't even know. Like, yeah.
Well, and I'm trying to think back to my experience asking for this, because it was when I was in a heightened state of anxiety, for a multitude of reasons in that pregnancy. And so I kind of asked them just to reassure my mind that maybe my anxieties weren't because something was wrong and I wasn't catching it, if that makes sense. And, and
so I remember you're always asking, like, on that fray of like, am I anxious because, or am I anxious? You know, it's, I don't know about you, but I had the hardest time trusting my intuition when I was pregnant after my loss, because my daughter was dead within me and I didn't even realize it. Like, I swear she kicked on the way to that appointment. We found out she died at, which she might have, but
Well, no. And I talk to people a lot about that, where they feel like they had a really good intuition before they experienced loss. And then they question every bad feeling they have, because they wonder if it's like some sort of psychic ability to know that something bad's about to happen, or is it just fear? And it's really hard to differentiate. And I was in a very vulnerable spot whenever I asked that sonographer. And I remember she was like, oh, well, we don't do that. It looks fine. And she kind of brushed me off so quickly to where I didn't feel like I could really push back, even though I'm a very pushy person. But
when you're pregnant, after loss, you're so tapped out already.
Yeah.
You want to trust that they're doing everything. Like, you have to be so hopeful that you're going to bring that baby home alive. And so like, and I've chatted with a lot of moms going through PAL, and you know, you only have so much energy at that point that you can expend. And like, it's so emotionally taxing on top of being physically tasking already. So that's why, like, we are trying to do what we can do to make it a standard of care, so that it's not something else to burden pregnant women, especially lost moms, with. Yep. That we want it to be something that is offered. There is a new Rainbow Clinic that opened in New York City at Mount Sinai, the Mount Sinai Rainbow Clinic. And Dr. Joanne Stone there is doing EPBs on her patients, which is really awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah. And like, so awesome for them to just get that care without having to advocate for it, without having to print off, like, here's the guide on how to measure the placenta, or like have those difficult conversations of like, doctor, I trust you and your expertise, and I want you to do this thing for me, you know, that you're not already doing. And then having to deal with that, like, pushback. Cause that was my experience in my second pregnancy with my daughter, Coral. When I learned about the CPD stuff, I felt so empowered and so fired up to like go to my MFM and be like, wow, we should be doing this. Remember, you said you didn't know how to do it. Like, here you go. And then my doctor just fought back with like, well, ACOG's not telling us that we have to do it. And well, this baby isn't growth restricted, so that's not important. And like, I think she discussed with me on the phone for 20 minutes on why to not. I was still actually sitting in the parking lot of my MFN when she called, when she had looked at Dr. Kleinman's info. So she spent 20 minutes discussing with me why she wouldn't do it rather than taking 30 seconds to measure an organ.
Interesting.
To just have such a more informed pregnancy. I want to touch on like why knowing the placenta size is important, you know, on top of, like I said, like in my experience with a growth restricted baby, that 37 weeks, the rate of stillbirth just like jumps exponentially every day that you remain pregnant. Especially when it comes to a small placenta. And so measuring the placenta in pregnancy could inform delivery timing. And so like talking back to Junie's pregnancy, if we had seen, you know, I was diagnosed as preeclampsia, and then if they had seen her placenta was small, they maybe wouldn't have pushed so far, you know, because at that point OB comes down to like out or in or out, like that is the decision. And the way it stands right now, there's so much more liability for providers to have a NICU baby than there is to have a dead baby. And that's so terrible.
Insane.
It's so terrible. And then there's that kind of talking about like the three miscarriages before we test things. There's the 39-week rule. No elective inductions before 39 weeks. Yes, this is not elective. There is a medical reason, but that does influence that. That, you know, like it kind of puts pressure on. And I remember that last week I was pregnant with Junie. It was like, stay pregnant. Like the worst case scenario was that I was going to have a NICU baby. I was going to have a baby born a little early. If only I knew then what I know now.
But you would know this now because of what you didn't know then, you know, it's important to point that out. Cause I know that feeling of like, I wish I could have done more, but.
Yes. And so that is what we're trying to do is to prevent this from happening to other people. I also want to point out that Elijah's mom, Elijah's story, he died the day before his due date and he was not growth restricted. And it was because his placenta was way too small and he outgrew his placenta. And so when my MFM doctor was arguing with me with my second baby that, well, this baby's not growth restricted, it's not important to look at the size, I was like, yes, it is. Like, it can happen. Like, that is a big deal. And one of the first, so Junie was growth restricted, so she was small, but then my fundal height, when they measure your belly, to, you know, from to the top of your uterus or whatever, my fundal height kept going further and further behind as well. You know, so then that means your uterus is not expanding. So, you know, baby's not taking up as much space. Placenta's not taking up as much space. So that can be a red flag too.
Did they ever mention that was a red flag to them, or it was just her measurements on the ultrasound?
It was just her growth measurements. And then how she was, you know, going lower on the charts. And then towards the end, it was my blood pressures were going up. And then I was having some other symptoms and diagnosed as preeclamptic. So. Yeah.
Wow. And I believe that I've read about, you know, placenta sizes, that there can also be on the opposite end where the placenta is too big. Yes. And I haven't seen a lot of discussion around that, but I didn't know if you knew anything about it also being too big.
Yes. So we do know of a few stories that has happened. We as our team, we focus more on the small placenta size. Just because we are more aware of those stories, and what that experience looks like, but just abnormal placenta size is a risk factor for stillbirth. whether that be too large or too small. So yes, that is also something, you know, that could be flagged if EPPs were being measured during pregnancy.
Yeah. No, I definitely found a lot less about it, but did find a few stories. There are definitely more of smaller placentas. And it's interesting that you say about the stillbirth rates after 37 weeks, because I threatened all of my doctors with their life if they made me go to my due date, because I refused. I had it in my head. Like, I'm like, at 37 weeks, if my baby is like 99% has a chance of being totally fine, not needing the NICU, then why wouldn't I want them to be born? And for me, that was a personal choice, to where as soon as I was 39 weeks, I was like, you're taking this baby out, because you won't let me do it any sooner.
Yeah.
Personally, that was my route both times. And that just for my mental well-being, if they would have let me go at 38 weeks, even, I would have done that.
Sure. I was, just to reference, I was induced at 37 weeks on the dot with both of my other girls. And I'm so grateful that I was able to do that. Like, Coral was born 2 days before Jenny's first birthday. And I don't know if I could have mentally been that pregnant. Like, you know, had the timing been a little bit different, and say I was like 34 weeks, like obviously you wouldn't induce at 34 weeks for no reason. But so I was so grateful that I was 37 weeks, 2 days, prior to Junie's first birthday. And then also to touch on what you were just talking about, ACOG actually recently put out a bulletin, that is their way of like informing providers on standards of care and things like that. That words are hard. This is why I'm a photographer. I can take cute pictures of all the things that are orange. But that they basically have like kind of opened the door to providers that if a family has had a previous loss, that a 37, 38 week induction is acceptable, as long as the parents are well aware of the possible risks of ending up in the NICU and things like that. And I think that is huge. That's a huge thing in kind of fighting that 39 week rule. And then that, to kind of loop it back to the small placenta work we're doing, is if a small placenta is identified in a pregnancy, that will inform the delivery timing, and not necessarily like, oh my gosh, there's a small placenta, we need to deliver right now. But like Junie's case, if it was small placenta, you have preeclampsia, you know, like then it starts like kind of adding up. It's like, okay, maybe that out is better than in.
Right.
And so then by doing that, by getting baby out, that is how you then prevent stillbirth from happening. So
would you consider, because I've used the term preventable stillbirth now a few times, because again, that's how I learned some of this stuff and found you, but would you consider measuring the placenta to be a way to prevent preventable stillbirth?
Absolutely. Like
what you would classify that under.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting. I had never heard the term preventable stillbirth before. And at first I was like, well, I don't know if I want to talk about that with people, because that makes me, at first I kind of feel like, well, what if, I don't want people to think that they can prevent everything, that everything is preventable on their part, but it is on their doctor's part if the doctor does the right thing.
Yes.
And has eyes on the patient, knows what they're doing, is up to date on the research and the information available. And so at that point, there are things that are preventable whenever it comes to stillbirth. And it's so hard to wrap our brains around that a lot of losses could have been prevented by proper medical care. And it's not at the fault of the mom. Most of us are asking for more eyes on us and more medical care. We're asking for all these things, but we're shot down constantly.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting. And as 100%. A doula who I advocate for other people, I'm much better at advocating for other people, but in my own pregnancies, I'm like cloudy and cannot form sentences.
It's bizarre. I remember when I would meet with my doctors, like, especially if I, you know, and all three of my pregnancies, oddly enough, like we're almost like all lined up timeline wise, which is like, my life is just a personal groundhog day. That, and then like Coral was about 6 months old when COVID happened. And so then like the world shut down. So like the 1 year that I wasn't pregnant, in 4 years, like nothing was, like we didn't go to like the country music festival and stuff, so it just like added to that. But anyways, when I was pregnant and I knew that like if it was like a hard, like you know, I was like hitting the anniversary of like Junie's anatomy scan when we found out she was growth restricted, and you know, then here I am pregnant with Coral a year later, I would ask my doctor, but I would voice record our conversations, because I felt like I got into that room and it was just like my abilities escaped me, because I was just so focused on like, what are we doing? You know, it was really hard to like stay present sometime, because, you know, just try to escape your brain as a way, or just like you said, you can be a pushy person, but then you get in that room and you're like, okay, can you measure the clothes? No, we can't. Oh, okay, it's fine. And then,
okay, sorry, I asked.
Then you go home and you're like, no, that's not fine. Like, no, right. Like, remember all that fire I had before this appointment? And then I'm just like, oh, okay. Like little mouse in the corner, you know, and it's, there's so much to navigate there, that like client to patient relationship. And then when you add in previous loss, and then, you know, you're involved in this space, I'm involved in this space, we are more knowledgeable on things pertaining to loss, when, and most, it just kind of feels like, I said this before, the doctors just kind of throw up their hands and say like, oh no, try again. Like, they don't want to like look at what happened. They don't want to feel like they failed in their care. And that's, right. You know, it's really frustrating. And then that kind of ties back into like, you know, if they do get a baby out sooner and then NICU time happens or whatever, they're at a bigger liability. So for them, it's easier for them. Like, that's their motivation to avoid that, which is so backwards. All of it's so backwards.
Yeah. And if I could have formed sentences, which, I mean, I had a live outcome, but I was so terrified. And I think some is that I know a lot at this point. With my first son's pregnancy, I had just had personal experience. I wasn't in this in a workspace environment. Mm-hmm. And now, like, that I advocate for other people and I hear other stories, I'm learning from those stories. And
absolutely,
that's a blessing and a curse. And so I remember just, I was totally fine for other people, but for me, just nope. And I sent a long email after my son was born and told them how I really felt, because it's also sad that in the medical field with loss, and whenever you try to advocate and they knock you down a little bit, you're kind of afraid to continue speaking up, because these are the people that are going to birth that child. Mm-hmm. And you want to be able to trust them and not have a bad relationship with them where you feel like they're not going to care for you the same way because you talked back to them, which sounds ridiculous.
No, absolutely. That is something our Measure the Placenta team talks about frequently. We talk about like how to approach your provider to ask for this to be done. And I think it's really important to always, you know, like approach it as like we're a team here. Because yeah, you're going to keep seeing them, you know, weekly, twice a week, whatever. And then they're going to birth your baby. So it's like, you want to, and you don't want them to like, it's so dumb, but you don't want them to like label you this like overly anxious mom, or just cause you've had a loss, or, you know, things like that. And yeah, that's always an interesting situation to be in, especially like you said, when you like get in there and then you can't form sentences. One advocacy tip we like to share is if you do present this, you know, either EPV or anything else you're, you know, reasonably asking for in your pregnancy and they're refusing, you can ask that they document your request and their refusal in your chart. Sometimes that is enough of a push for them to be like, oh, okay, like let's take this 30-second measurement. Like, let's see what this is all about. Obviously, like, you know, approach that nicely. Don't like be threatening. Oh,
I'm glad you said that, because I'm sitting here thinking about how I would approach it not so nicely.
Yeah. And sometimes if you freeze up at your appointments, you can make that request and the request for them either to like do an EPB or request that they document your request and their refusal. You can do that like via your My Chart or things like that. It's really powerful to have that on paper. Yeah. And then I think it kind of starts supporting that like possible liability situation, you know, versus them just like having a conversation. A big thing that doctors push back to us about is there's not been like very large scale studies done yet, because come to find out, they don't typically measure placentas of live births. And so there's not like consistent consistency across like states and reporting and things like that. And there's a lot of missing reporting happening when it comes to stillbirth too. So yes, like if you've had a loss, your hospital, like I said, takes those cuts. They put that in your chart, but it's not like that goes to anywhere else, that like no one's seeing these trends of like, oh my gosh, another small placenta stillbirth. Like, oh wow, yeah, this baby was stillborn and look, that was, you know, like no one's like connecting all those dots. There's a huge, huge legislative bill. Sorry, I can't talk very well. I got Invisalign recently. So if you're struggling with my list, so am I. A big legislation in the works right now called the Shine for Autumn Act, which has been really shared about by Push Pregnancy, Push for Empowered Pregnancy Group, which is our co-team with us. And they are working hard to pass this legislation so that a lot of those things can be standardized when it comes to stillbirth. And then that would have the ripple effect of then preventing stillbirth and reducing stillbirth rates, which have not changed since like the 80s in the United States. It's really sad. Another, let me see, I'm trying to think of other ways, like you said, about when you're in there with your doctor, how to like advocate for yourself.
I did want to say, because you mentioned that there's not a lot of studies, and I literally just created an Instagram post, which at the time of that this is live, people can go and see about Cytotech. There are 3 studies that I've been able to find that are public, and they're all like, the results are inconclusive, not enough information. And we're still giving that to people at home. Yeah. 4 times the dose is what's used in a hospital to let them just give birth at home without any medical attention. So if anybody says, well, I'm not going to measure your placenta because there's not enough data on it, I could make a list of things that there's not enough data on, and we are sent home to do on our own. So,
Yeah.
Sorry, like those words are like a trigger word to me, because
I feel
there's so many things that we don't have enough data on, but we continue to be recommended to do those things, you know? So
Kind of like the three miscarriages before we check on things. And actually, like I recently learned through Push Pregnancy's Stillbirth Symposium that this whole like 39-week rule, it really, you know, there's kind of like a methodology for things to become standard practice, to become a standard of care. And this 39-week rule just kind of became this thing without going through that whole process. And so it's just kind of crazy that now we have something that just like makes sense, but it's, you know, it's not becoming a thing because it's not going through this process. But yet there's so many things that we are doing that have not gone through this whole process to become a standard, but yet they are standards. And that's just
my theory on the 39 week is that they assume most women go into labor by the 39th week on their own, so it doesn't clog up their schedule, their staff to make the scheduling, you know, the resources to plan ahead, because their system just works when people are going into labor. And so that's kind of my theory, to where they assume everybody will go into labor. When I should add, it's interesting, you know, we talk about non-invasive testing, that it's available. And another thing that I really stress to my clients, especially, is checking the cervix, which you can also do non-invasively by ultrasound. Yeah. And I was so like pushy about them checking my cervix that I thought that something was going to happen to my cervix my entire pregnancy. And both times I never dilated, not even a centimeter. So I was so worried the whole time. And
that was,
I had
that
the
was
most
your body like
cervix.
Giving you the Junie finger, like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Like it just, it's so, but you know, I would rather push for something and be completely wrong.
Right.
I will apologize for pushing later if that thing does not come true, but to me, that gave me peace of mind. And so I,
or you will look at your living baby in your arms and be like, wow, like the, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even think you should have to apologize.
No,
like,
you're right.
That is the point of medical care, is it's, you know, to keep us healthy, to keep our babies healthy, to keep our babies alive, you know? And
but think.
Yeah, I'm with you. you would think. And kind of on that note, kind of back to like your advocacy and your empowerment in your pregnancy, that it's important to like track those kicks, track baby's movements, and know that you can go in and get checked at any time. Like that is what they are there for. And we want to fight this like mentality of this anxious pregnant woman. Like you should always feel welcome to go in and get checked. And to not feel like you're bugging them. And then, yeah. And like you were saying about like, delivery timing too. It's so much I hear of like, oh, you know, my doctor works Tuesday, so that will work better or whatever. And it's like, why are we letting that control our baby's health? Like it's, mm-hmm. there's so much of our medical system that's just so backwards. And, you know, when we know so better, backwards. We do better and we should be doing better.
Well, and it's people can't see my sweatshirt, but it says mental health is health. And I yes. tried to argue with my OB at the end of my fourth pregnancy, my second living son, that I wanted to be induced before 39 weeks because my mental health was a mess. And I mm-hmm. physically could not, I physically and mentally could not take being pregnant another day. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted mm-hmm. my baby to be here and I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And they argued with me that that was not an acceptable reason to get a scheduled induction. And I'm just like, you people are killing me. Like I'm dying, like mentally not okay. And I'm telling my doctors this and they're telling me
yeah. that. And again, it's not like you were 30 weeks and you're like, get this baby out. Like,
oh no, it was like, know? I started talking to them about it at 35 reasonable. Weeks and yeah. And I was like, how about we do it at 37 weeks? I even yeah. was like, let's compromise for 38 weeks. And then they yeah. would blame COVID restrictions. They would blame so many scheduling. Things. And yeah. And at one point this could just be an example of a horrible doctor, but, they would do the, okay. You said I can't think of words either.
It's like we're in our pregnancy appointments again.
Yeah. It's the ultrasound version of an NST.
BPP, biophysical profile. Yeah.
Yes. They had me do those weekly at 35 weeks. Again, because they had my BMI wrong. And so I was considered high risk because they had me listed as obese. And so they had me do those and they charged me for every single one of them without telling me that it was like something I needed to do. And because I was anxious, I was like, I'm going to do it because I want to see my baby and make sure yeah. that they're breathing. But like it's just weird the thing.
But then it like kind of came back to bite you in the butt almost, or like, okay, like now we're going to make this a bigger issue for like, you're doing this for your mental health and then you have to pay for it. So then it's like, it's this vicious cycle. It doesn't make sense. I had a similar experience of, when I was about 35 weeks pregnant, with Jersey and I went into the ditch. Someone pulled out in front of me. So our vehicles did not crash. I would have T-boned him if he hadn't gotten out of my way. And I went into the ditch and like, we were fine, but like mentally, and I had my seatbelt on and no airbags and all of that. But like mentally, I knew I wanted to go in and get checked just because given Junie's experience that if the next day something was wrong, I would not have forgiven myself, you know? Yeah. And now like, and we did not make any sort of insurance claim. Like our vehicles did not hit, you know,
right.
And I went in and I just let them know like, yep, my car had went into the ditch pretty hard. But like, I just need a check given my previous history. And now months later, I got a bill in the mail for it because they don't want to cover it because it was elective. It was like an extra check or something. And I That's was like, insane. this is why, you know, the day before Junie died, I'm at home and baby's not moving. And I think like all of these reasons right. in our society, like, nope, don't go in and get checked, which is so wrong. Like
it is
so wrong. Yeah. And like, look at you, like you're dealing with really hard mental health stuff. So you want to go get checks and then you're getting a bill and you're like, okay, what is this? You know?
Yeah. The state of our country and like all women's health is just down the drain and it's just continuing Absolutely. To get worse. But mm-hmm. you know, we go into financial debt over pregnancy and that pregnancy doesn't even always equal a baby. And then we're mm-hmm. still billed and we're billed for just it's insane. It's absolute insanity.
Absolutely insane. I loved sarcasm. Getting a bill for $986 for a level 2 MFM growth ultrasound. For them to tell me there was no fetal cardiac activity.
Like, that they have to make money, but like, can't they write some things off or like,
yeah,
you know, like, can't they, I don't know. It's just,
Or so, maybe there's so many things that need to be improved. There's so much room for improvement. Like, I feel like at the very least, if your baby dies, a social worker should be like assigned to you to like filter those bills through to like, you know, like here I am getting funeral home paperwork in the mail stacked on top of an ultrasound bill. Like that is so messed up and it should not be that way.
And not a single, I'm not going to assume not a single resource, but like, you're not really, you're not given a ton of bereavement support after a loss. You know, I think it's really rare to be given a lot of really great resources, or usually I find that labor and delivery nurses who have personal experience with loss will talk to that patient and give them resources, but there's no like mandate of, whenever a mom goes through a loss, this is what we do. We have a social worker for the hospital. We have somebody to cover, you know, calling the funeral home. I had one girl tell me the story of right before she was induced, it was a stillbirth situation as well. They were like, so where do you want her cremated? And she was like, I have no idea. I haven't had time to Google funeral homes in the area because I just learned that my baby was dead. And it's just,
and like, here I'm in a hospital bed right now. Like, this is so wrong. Like,
next to a room where a live baby is crying and screaming while you're giving birth to your dead baby. It's just, there's
such a disconnect,
but you would think that there wouldn't be because we're human beings. It's just, it's baffling.
And I echo that so much, like all of the work that I've done on my personal Instagram and now with Measure the Placenta, you hear such a range of experiences and most of them, you know, are pretty terrible or lacking support, lacking, you know, I remember after Junie was born, I requested all of my records. Cause then I'm like, okay, due date change, that shouldn't happen. And by the way, her placental pathology, her autopsy, and so many other things supported her being 38 weeks and 2 days gestation and not 36 and three, like they changed it to. So that like is reassuring to me, I guess, of that, like, you know, that we were just too late to get her out and we should have gotten her out sooner when she was struggling. But I remember looking at my paperwork and like my discharge paper from the hospital when Junie was born was like grief, and it was like labeled like acceptable grief or something, or like there was a note from like my doctor that was like, oh, she's grieving but that's okay. It's like, no shit, sorry, I hope it's okay, I swear.
No, that's okay.
Like, no shit, like my kid died after being watched so closely by my doctors. I was not educated on counting my baby's movements, and then I had to give birth to her. Like, of course I'm grieving. Like, It felt so stupid that they had to like note that or something. Like, I was like, that is so messed up.
And the word acceptable, like, who are they to determine what's acceptable
way to
grieve? Like, because of your appearance, you're number one, you are postpartum, you're traumatized, you are sad as hell. Like,
I was just like, I think I laughed at how ridiculous that was.
Is ridiculous.
Like, I was like, oh, well, no cap. Like, you don't say, like, I'm calling a funeral home while I'm like getting an epidural. Like, that is
insane. Yeah.
Insane. Of course I'm grieving. Like, no way, no way, Jose.
That whole thing. I mean, that is so, so strange.
Yes.
Well, I would love if you could tell our audience what ways they could get involved with Measure the Placenta, what Measure the Placenta, you know, offers. I'm going to put the how to measure the placenta page in the notes for this episode. That way people can simply click on it. Cause it's filled with really great information. It links to that app that you mentioned for both Android and iPhone.
We also, you should put in the show notes. We have like a little flyer, we call it, that has five fast facts about measuring placentas, why it's important to pay attention to placental size during pregnancy, that a small placenta can be a risk factor for stillbirth, and that, you know, detecting a small placenta could then prevent stillbirth. So that's a one that we've encouraged people to print out as a way to help them have that conversation with their providers, or email it or send it my chart. whatever. If people want to follow us on social media, on Instagram, we are at Measure the Placenta, just spelled out. Our website is measuretheplacenta.org. We also have a Facebook profile, Measure the Placenta. And we, you know, it's 2022. We do a lot of online type of events, Instagram lives, Facebook lives. The Push Pregnancy, Push for Empowered Pregnancy, they do a silver symposium that's been held virtually. We've got a big awareness event coming up in October called the Big Push. And that's hopefully going to just give us some visibility in DC about all of the ways care is lacking, all of the ways that we can make improvements. So follow our social media channels in order to kind of see, to stay updated, join in on one of our live events. We host or we do like Clubhouse and live events often with Dr. Kleiman. So if you have any specific questions for him, join in one of those events and you can ask him a question at the end of the discussion, which is huge. And those are so, like, I always come away from those chats with just like more information, even though I've been doing this for a few years now. Like, it's always like you learn something new there. So that's really helpful. And then if you've had a loss and you think it could be due to a placental issue, and that should have been it should have been a fact that I started with, is that more often than not, you can learn about your baby's cause of death from the placenta, especially versus an autopsy or any other type of testing. The placenta just tells you so much about the health of the pregnancy. So if you have had a loss, I would encourage you to look into getting a placental pathology report done by Dr. Kleiman. We learn so much more information about Jeannie's placenta, not just the size, but like the actual like makeup of it. And then it gave us a lot of information that we could use in my future pregnancies as well, to, you know, figure out if it was like a genetic cause or things like that. So that's a really powerful route to go as well.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
I don't think so. I feel like, I know I've learned a lot. I've been wanting to learn even more about the causes of stillbirth and, you know, how we can kind of fight against that. And as birth workers in general, like what we can do to help. And so I'm so appreciative of you for educating us, sharing your story, you know, giving us all the things. And I always love in these conversations that it's such a dark topic that brings us here, but we're still able to like weirdly laugh about things. We love laughing at our pain.
Oh yeah. So if you follow my personal Instagram lately, I've just been all the dark humor. That's where I'm at in my grief. And sometimes people are like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe she just said that. But it's like, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. Like, yeah. I think I might've referenced this earlier, but, when our daughter was born, my husband took a picture of her flipping the bird, and it has become known as the Junie finger. And
so cute.
I feel like that is just like the best way to sum up how terrible all of this is and how we need to do better.
I agree.